we are saying that we need to conclude the process of appointing a permanent leadership in the Empowerment Enterprise Development Division, which is one half of the former divided into the Industrial Development Division and the Enterprise Development Division. We need to make those appointments. And then I think what we need to see is a refinement of the support program for SME enterprise development. We have been deploying a deputy minister, and Thuli has been going around all the provinces. I think we wanted to continue that work, because in addition to whatever kinds of formal reports or formal targets we get, what we really need to get to know is the impact of those programs on the ground. And from that knowledge, to also then refine and deepen those programs. We need to, in addition to that, we need to find a new model for the SAWEN, South African Women Entrepreneur Network, and more broadly the advance the question of women's empowerment. Then another part of this work here is the BEE Advisory Council, which has now been appointed, and we'll be having a two-day session early next month. The BEE Advisory Council we see as a very, very important body. It is actually provided for, of course, in the Act. It is appointed by the President, and the President is the chair of the Advisory Council. And the Advisory Council, we put to them some very important, serious challenges. We think that the research that we're aware of will indicate to us that the impact of empowerment at all across the economy is actually quite modest. But insofar as there is some impact of empowerment, it's not sufficient in the areas of the link with enterprise development, with local production development and things of that sort. And so we're putting those kinds of issues and debates into discussion in the BEE Advisory Council. And then we want to achieve through that a way forward in terms of BEE, but also in terms of the alignment issues that we have identified, among other things, in the IPAC. In the area of consumer and corporate regulation, the major piece of legislation that will be coming your way in the course of this year is a piece of legislation around indigenous knowledge. We will be putting forward a legislative proposal, which would incorporate into our existing IP legislation recognition of indigenous knowledge, and that bill will be coming to yourself. And we think that's a very important piece of legislation. And it will be on your calendar in the course of this year. Then the other one is the Companies Act. We have already done the rectification exercise. A number of errors have crept into the Companies Act, and also the regulations. We want the Companies Act to come into force as it is supposed to do. In the course of this year, we think it's a very, very important piece of legislation. It actually marks a major departure in terms of our company law. We think it gives us a company legislative framework which is second to none in the world, actually. There's some very new features about cutting of red tape for registering of companies, reducing the costs of registering companies. Things like the business rescue scheme, we think, are very, very important new procedures. So we want to get that going this year. And that also requires that we deal with some of the issues and problems we've been confronting in Cipro. And we are completing the investigation, and we will have taken some decisions by the next little while arising from that. And we want to get Cipro operating effectively as it should be, because it is then going to migrate into becoming the commission that deals with company and intellectual property registration. We've been doing this work on trying to change the Lotteries Board. We've appointed, you have appointed a new Lotteries Board, and I've agreed with your nominations, the new lotteries board is up and running. And we are looking to that lotteries board to basically get through the backlog of distributions. We've filled every single distribution agency. We've done it timelessly as the vacancies have arisen. We've introduced some new procedures. We've introduced some new regulations, and we're introducing even some amendments as the Lotteries Act. We have got the Gambling Review Commission, which is going on this year, which we want to report on by the middle of the year. I'll just describe it in those general terms. They're holding their hearings now, and it's going to be out of that review commission, together with your own report and your own deliberations on that, as well as the deliberations of the Gambling Council, which is ourselves and the provinces. That's what we believe shape our decisions about future new forms of gambling that we will accept or not accept, and where we will draw the line on gambling. Then I should have said perhaps that on CIPRO, once we've got some stability in CIPRO, we want to start setting in targets in terms of the time frames for registering companies and things like that. We think it's still too slow. There's still too many errors and problems creeping up in the register. We want to set some targets in that regard. On international trade and economic development, well, there are ongoing negotiations, the WTO, the Economic Partnership Agreement. This is ongoing work which may or may not have a dynamic that requires engagement from us in the course of the year. But our focus will be on developing new engagements with China, India, Brazil. In fact, there will be an IPSA forum, India, Brazil, South Africa, next month. And we will be using that occasion to push forward some discussions we've been having quite fruitfully with Brazil about how we can strengthen our trade in a complementary way, as well as rooted in cooperative arrangements. We will be negotiating a start with India on a preferential trade agreement, and we will be looking to reach an agreement with China in which they cooperate with us to try to bring about a more equitable balance of trade. We want to spend a considerable amount of time and focused attention this year on the integration process in SADC, how we look to that, and our approach is that we want to see a developmental approach. We are wary of premature leaps into customs unions and things like that. And we believe that there is an important piece of inbuilt work which can have some very, very important benefits for regional integration and for South Africa in particular, and that is the SADC East African Community COMESA process. The establishment of a free trade area between those three blocks would bring into being a free trade area quite literally from Cape to Cairo on the east coast of the continent. 700 million people would be involved in that. That is a very sizable free trade area, and you could see that the next stage from that would be to start discussions with ECOWAS and West Africa. Then I think that we have an investment protection agreement with Zimbabwe, which we will be hopefully bringing to the Parliament within the next few weeks for your consideration for ratification. But we will also be bringing through Cabinet and eventually to your attention a document on what is our approach to investment protection agreements in general. That's a fairly difficult and bizarre jurisprudence that has arisen from some of these, and that's led us to reconsider some of the things that we will and will not be willing to enter into with other countries, the way some of the clauses are formulated and so on, and we will be doing that. Then in terms of our trade investments, South Africa trade promotion activities, one of our big focuses this year, very obviously, is the FIFA Soccer World Cup, which will be an occasion where there will be lots and lots of business people coming to the country, as well as obviously soccer fans. I mean, it's quite interesting how I observed that quite important companies are also sponsors, international companies are sponsors of national teams. They will be down here on that occasion. We will be hosting here in Cape Town during the World Cup a very, very important event, which is the Time Warner 500 global economic forum conference. This is a major meeting of top business people. The last one took place in China in 2005. We have scored that during the World Cup. That will be a major event for us during that time. But I think we also anticipate that we will be spending a lot of time talking to incoming people during the FIFA World Cup. And then we need to that I think will be our biggest focus, although there are a number of outgoing missions, particularly missions that are accompanying state visits. There's been a few already this year. Next week there will be one going to Uganda, but there's a number of other state visits on the card. In terms of administration, let me just say there are two big things. We have appointed our Chief Operating Officer, Jody Stoltz, who's behind here. And Jody is the Chief Operating Officer of the department, the whole new position. One of the tasks that we've given her within the framework of what we've been saying for the Department of Continuous Improvement is we're going to ask you doctors to go around and look at all the systems and procedures and the way we work in the PCI, and I think the Minister's office is not exempt from that. Go around and then give us a report of things that we need to do to improve. Not looking for big changes in organograms and things like that, there would be a higher premium on those kind of proposals, but there are things that we can do in terms of reducing our turnaround times. Who is in the signing queue for memoranda, things like that? Is it rational? Is it reasonable? Is the turnaround time too long, or are we doing it okay? Those are the kind of issues that we want. How are the call centers working? How is the outreach to the public working? I think those are all the things that we're asking, and we're going to get a report from that in the near future. We have an expo scheduled, I can't recall exactly when it is, I think it's next month. And then another thing, another piece of work which we're doing as well, is we have sensed, particularly in the industrial policy work, that when we have filled some of the positions which we have filled, because we've filled quite a number of positions since this administration, including the DDG, we find that the pool of available people with the requisite skills is actually quite small in this country. Most of our higher education training institutions are not turning out people that see their career path as coming to work in industrial policy in the DDI, that sort of thing. So we're engaging some of the higher education institutions on this issue, and we will be having an important bilateral. We've already started talking to the Department of Higher Education and Training. So those are the sort of highlights. Let me just say one other thing that is fairly important, which will be there in the STRAC plan, but certainly there in the ENE. And that is that we have agreed to transfer some of the entities that report to the DTI to the Economic Development Department. These are the competition authorities, the Industrial Development Corporation, KULA, SAMAP, and then there is a further discussion ongoing of a co-responsibility for international trade with the Administration Commission, ITAC. And let me just say here that I think that it's probably important that we just share some of the thinking around this. This is a very large department that's involved in policies which are requiring the cooperation of a number of different parts of government. And so we've taken the view that the appointment of the Economic Development Department by the President is in fact something very, very welcome and important, because now we have an entity which can take this kind of bigger cross-government view and identify all the different contributions which are required, and we think also that the monitoring and evaluation process will be something which can bring us all together. What we badly need to do in government, I think this is the conclusion for some time, is break out of the silo mentality. And so when economic development indicated a desire to take over the running of these, what we've agreed with them is that this will not mean that we don't have operational access to all of those institutions. And built into the agreement that we have what we call walking rights. We could continue to do all the work that we want to do with the IDC and everything of that sort. In fact, the COTIC, Council of Trade Industry Institutions, will continue to meet as we have done before. But what will happen is that the ability to give quality time all the entities that report to the have reported to the authority to the DPR will now be shared between ourselves and EDD. And quite honestly, when there are so many of them, 19 of them, it's quite difficult to be quite honest to give quality time to all of them and also all the other parts of the DPI. So if we are now sharing that, and some of the key ones are now going to be looked at on an ongoing basis with a lot of quality intervention by my colleague, Minister Patel, so much it will improve our ability as governors to deliver on our mandate. So we haven't seen this. We've seen this as very much a new way of working together, breaking down silos, and that's the approach which we've adopted. So I think there are a couple of institutional things that arise from that, which you'll see covered in the stress plan and the estimate of national expenditure. But basically, as far as the operational ability is concerned, I'm of the view that it has only enhanced our capacity as government to deliver on our mandate. So I think those are the kind of introductory remarks I'd want to make, and I would suggest, if you don't mind, Chair, I would suggest that the DG perhaps starts by introducing the team. I didn't introduce everybody. I should really at least let me introduce my colleague, Deputy Minister Suli, but let him introduce the other parts of the team, and I think let him go through the formal presentation, and then I think we can engage on all of that. As I said at the beginning, I'm sure that everything I've said is adequately catered for in the strat plan. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Minister, Honourable Members, Chair. I'm not going to introduce the team. I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves, starting with the back.
Nimrod Belk, Deputy Director General, Industrial Development Division.
Good morning, Jody Scott, Group COO.
Good morning, Xavier Karim, International Trade and Economic Development Division.
Good morning, Tumela Chukwuka, the Enterprise Organization.
My name is Mpho Ramatla from the Office of the CFO. Mpho Ramatla from the Office of the CFO.
Good morning, Kash Bieber, Office of the CFO, DDI.
Good morning, Honourable Members. I'm Sarah Chwane. I'm heading the corporate arm of the department.
Good morning, Members. My name is Zodwan Duli. I'm the Deputy Director General responsible for regulation.
Morning, Chairperson. My name is Rian Leroux. I'm representing Trade and Investment South Africa. My DDG will be joining us shortly as he's landing from abroad within the next few minutes.
Thank you. That seems to be it, Chair. Oh, the staff of the department. Okay. The minister. All right. Okay. Let me proceed. Chair, our medium-term strategic framework has already been circulated and has been with yourselves for a little while, and I'm sure that you
have engaged with it. What I'm going to do is to cover the broad highlights of the study. We're going to tell you that we can engage on the details and with the discussion.
This is how we structure the presentation. I'll flip quickly through the current economic context, key achievements, because our work going forward builds on what we've been doing, and what we're trying to do going forward is to up our game, as the Minister has said, in key areas, and I'll touch on those. We've organized our strategy in accordance with those themes that are reflected there, industrial development, which really, you know, constitutes the flagship, you know, program of the department. Trade, investment, exports, broadening participation, regulation, administration and coordination, and of course, we'll look at the budgets and then reflect finally on some of the challenges that we confront. In terms of the context, the current context, this slide basically reflects what we're all observing, the turnaround in the economic developments, the outlook going forward looking promising, but we're also making the point that there are some risks that remain that we need to be careful around to ensure that we build the momentum of the economy's recovery going forward. Some of this will build on the work we've been doing on the framework response to the international economic crisis, which is a tripartite process located at NEDLAC and led by the Economic Development Department, as well as the work on the growth path, which is also coming from the Economic Development Department, because the point really is that, which we'll be making, is that we really must begin to look at how we do things differently in the economy. We can't continue to do the same old things and expect to get different results. And in that context, we believe that our work on industrial policy, in particular the item 2, will be an important element of our work of developing the economy and trying to restore growth and employment creation. Now, in terms of key highlights, the work on IPEP 2 is work which we've been undertaking over the last financial year. And clearly, going forward, this will be a rolling action plan, which means that as we begin to implement some of the actions we've identified, we'll be already looking at, you know, the next set of actions going forward. So it's going to be interactive, iterative process of developing the industrial economy. We've also finalized the automotive production and development program and are developing the guidelines for the investment scheme that is part of that program. We've developed a new support program for loading and textiles, focusing on enhancing productivity and competitiveness of the sector. We've reviewed our technical infrastructure, which will constitute an important area of our work in defending our economy and the industrial economy in particular. We are rolling out new incentive schemes, which we finalized in the previous financial year, the Enterprise Investment Program, Business Process Sourcing, and a revised film incentive. We've also, as the committee will be aware, finalized the trade policy and strategy review document, which we are now undertaking consultations on in NEDLAC. Key highlights on bilateral engagements is the agreement that we've concluded to protect investment with Zimbabwe, work on spatial development initiatives, particularly with Namibia and Angola. These are new sort of projects. Then MOUs on economic cooperation with Zambia and Senegal. As regards SADC, as the Minister has indicated, our focus is to consolidate SADC, extend it to services sector, which was already identified as the next phase in developing SADC. And then, of course, beginning to develop a work program around the SADC East African Community and Commerce Trilateral Trade Arrangements. We're working with our partners in SACU on strengthening, you know, key relationships with Mercosur, Brazil, India, China, and also the U.S. With regard to the EU, we're all engaging in the EPA process, and we'll continue to engage in that process to ensure that the outcomes are positive for us. The WTO Doha round, we will continue to engage in order to ensure that the round delivers a development outcome. So it's a really important area of our focus, even as we do these other things. In the area of trade and investment promotion, we've undertaken a number of missions related to the President's visits to Angola, Zambia, Brazil, Nigeria, and recently we've just come back from the UK. Those are the numbers of business people have taken on these visits. We facilitated key investments, and I highlight the investments in the automotive sector, the BMW Ford, which we're about to launch fairly soon. In the area of enterprise development, subsequent to the approval for Kula to explore lending directly, we've been working on a business case. Now, this work will be taken forward by the Economic Development Department because Kula will now report to them. CEDA has now been stabilized and is delivering services, and as the Minister has indicated to Deputy Minister Manduli, is looking at just how we improve on the quality of the services and some of the problems that are arising with the delivery of services to small enterprises. We have also reviewed the strategy for cooperatives, because this is an area where we think that we have not done very well and would like to, going forward, up our game in the area of cooperatives. So the strategy is finalized, being consulted among parties, all social partners in NetLife. And so we will be engaging with yourself, I'm sure, on this going forward. We've also reviewed the work on enterprise, women enterprise programs, focusing on SAWIN, just to reposition that, because that work has not really had the impact that we'd like it to have. It remains an important area for women economic empowerment and women enterprise. And DEE, a number of charters have been converted in the last financial year, and we've also, as the Minister has indicated, launched the Advisory Council. In the area of regulation, we are busy with implementation of the bills that were passed in the previous financial year, 2008-2009. They are reflected there, companies, competition, consumer protection. We are developing the regulations, business cases for the new public entities, and conducting awareness campaigns. We've undertaken also new law reform and policy initiatives in the area of estate agents, lotteries, gambling, and intellectual property. In administration and coordination, we are implementing a targeted recruitment strategy to fill key positions. Minister has indicated the group chief operating officer, as well as other key positions in the different divisions, also including the new divisions that have been created. We are undertaking various initiatives to enhance our human resources, improving our IT infrastructure, as well as conducting awareness and training on fraud and corruption prevention in the department. Going forward, as I indicated, industrial development will constitute the main priority, the main focus, and there it will be rolling out the IPEP 2, which we have recently launched and the committee is seized with. The specific areas of focus are going to be obviously the sectors, looking at some of the conditionalities associated with our industrial financing, as well as beginning to strengthen our monitoring and evaluation capacity for all of these things, particularly in the light of the fact that we are going to be committing with the cabinet, with the president, on certain delivery targets, very tough delivery targets, which are going to require that we strengthen our monitoring and evaluation going forward. Government procurement will be an important area of focus, and you know what we are proposing in item 2, more strategic procurement, fleet procurement. And of course, standards with respect to our technical infrastructure to ensure that we protect our market against and say even poor quality imports while promoting our exports, standards of our exports in foreign markets. We're looking at new opportunities in regard to the industrial economy, new sectors that have got potential going forward in the area of the green economy, as well as energy efficiency. The area of coordination across different spheres of government will be an important area of our focus in regard to implementing industrial policy, but in particular ensuring that the industrial development zone program is improved, is strengthened going forward. It constitutes a very important item, expenditure item on our budget, and we really need to stabilize the program going forward. Trade, investment, and exports. Our focus will be on continued bilateral engagements, particularly with Africa, where I think there's scope for us to strengthen our relations, strategic relations with key economies. We've spoken about the SDIs that will continue to be a methodology we use in this context, as well as various technical cooperation relationships with a number of countries. Regional integration will continue to be an important focus for us, you know, in regard to SACU, ensuring that we address some of the problems in SACU, coordination problems and the policy gaps that exist in SACU that are holding the customs union back. Also exploring other arrangements that may present themselves in regard to the region. And of course, we've mentioned the trilateral SADC, East African Community Commerce, FTA. That's going to be a very important initiative over the medium term going forward. In regard to bilaterals with the rest of the world, particularly the South, those countries, Brazil, India, and China, will continue to be a key focus. We'll be looking at complementarities, new models of trade agreements that ensure that we leverage on each other's strengths with these economies, while focusing on obviously consolidating our relations with our traditional markets, the U.S., Europe, and Japan. I've mentioned Doha, still on our radar screen, and of course we will implement some of the agreements that we've concluded, the investment treaty with Zimbabwe, on which, by the way, a lot of potential investment into Zimbabwe is dependent. So what happens with this agreement, I think, is going to be critical in turning the economic fortunes of Zimbabwe, at least in the short term. Further work on exports, promotion. We will implement a strategy that we've adopted, targeting key markets, key products, as well as a range of investment promotion activities, focusing on the sectors that we've identified in IPEP. Broadening participation, BEE will be an area of focus. A number of things are outstanding in regard to BEE. The legislation clearly needs to be reviewed. There are a number of gaps that have been identified, so we'll be developing proposed amendments to the legislation. The alignment of the legislation with various other legislations, procurement legislation, for example, is an important area. We've started this work. It needs to be finalized. Depends on what the Treasury is with their review of procurement regulations. We've made our inputs. The verification of BEE, that system has got challenges that need addressing to strengthen the capacity of the verification sectors to ensure that we can monitor the progress with regard to BEE. And, of course, the department will be the secretariat for the advisory council, so we will be supporting the work program that arises out of the advisory council. Cooperatives, as I've indicated, we're looking at really raising our game here. The policy and legislation has been reviewed. There will be amendments to the legislation, and we'll set up a new institutional mechanism to advance the work on cooperatives. SMMEs will continue to ensure that CEDA improves service delivery to SMMEs and cooperatives. There's work that we've been undertaking that also needs to be concluded and implemented around procurement opportunities for SMMEs, particularly by government. There's huge scope, I think, for us to support SMMEs by facilitating access to markets, particularly government procurement markets. So we've identified the products that we think we could actually usefully procure from small businesses. Youth enterprises is an important new area of focus going forward, so we will be doing work in regard to that, in line with the policy direction around youth development in our country. And I've also mentioned women enterprise. In the area of regulation, we will continue to exercise oversight in key markets. Even though the Competition Commission will shift to economic development, we will maintain a keen interest in the activities of the Competition Commission, the competition authorities, to explain that it's important for our work on industrial policy, on industrial development. The work on putting in place regulations in terms of the new acts, companies and consumers will continue, as well as launching the new public entities that are envisaged in this legislation. We'll implement the outcomes of the reviews that we're conducting on the estate agents, national lotteries. I think the Act as well clearly requires strengthening the number of loopholes that we've identified. The gambling area is important, and the work of the gambling review will be important to inform how we take this area going forward. We're also reviewing regulation of liquor to strengthen that, as well as the work on intellectual property. In fact, the bill on indigenous knowledge will be tabled in Parliament in this current session. The oversight of key regulatory agencies would like to strengthen that to ensure that turnaround times are improved and service delivery generally is improved in regard to lotteries, the distribution of lottery funds, CPRO in regard to registration of companies, intellectual property. Would like to benchmark the turnaround times in accordance with some of the comparable economies. We're looking at setting those benchmarks for those entities, credit regulation, consumer, as well as the estate agency and liquor area. These are entities that transact with the public, and so we'd like to ensure that we maintain high standards of service delivery, as well as promote awareness of the activities of these entities, directions of our regulation, legislation, and so on. Administration and coordination, we will be implementing service delivery improvement plans which have been developed in the department. ICT, ensure that we leverage ICT in supporting service delivery and productivity of the department, strengthen our management of our human resources and skills, ensure that we align our recruitment with our priorities. So the key areas that have been identified need to be supported quite strongly. We want to improve our performance in regard to disability, the recruitment of disabled people into the department. Clearly, scope for improving, as well as revising the fraud prevention plan to strengthen our corporate governance. The DTI website, I think, is due for revamping. We've already started this work on revising the website. We'll be implementing a new website fairly soon. We would like to ensure that we maintain regular media engagement to ensure that the work of the department is publicized and that we engage with the public on our work and our performance. We'll undertake targeted campaigns into key constituencies to promote the offerings of the department. We'll review the channels that we're using to transact on our products and services, and also enhance customer contact points. Coming to the resources of the department through the medium term, they are reflected there. And you'll see that key priorities will be industrial development and industrial financing and incentives. I think the figures speak for themselves. We'll engage on them. If there are any questions? This is the trend line of our budget over the last few years. We, as you will see, we spend the money that we allocated to the department. And clearly, with the stronger department, there will be scope for us to enhance our offerings, to enhance our impact as a department. And this will be obviously dependent on how the budget, the state budgets perform going forward. To the extent that there will be scope to increase our budget, we think that we are quite capable of enhancing our impact as a department. The last slide speaks to some of the challenges. Clearly, the recession and its impacts on the economy is a key challenge confronting us. How we recover the jobs that were lost, how we support enterprises that are in distress as a result of the recession, clearly will become an important challenge for us. The whole reorganization of government, the creation of new departments, is clearly having an impact because I think as we go forward, our work is going to depend on the stability and effectiveness of the partner departments, particularly those departments that will be doing industrial policy, the implementation of industrial policy. Capacity constraints is an area of challenge, so we will be looking at how we continue to innovate in attracting skills into this department. We want to ensure that we operate on the basis of effective ICT infrastructure, so we will be paying attention to our ICT. And I've mentioned the area of disability, improving our performance in regard to recruiting in this area, as well as women, the gender composition of our staff, particularly in the management segments. And of course, coordination across the three tiers of government, because our work cuts across all tiers of government, and there's scope for us to improve coordination in that regard. Chair, that concludes the presentation. I went through it very quickly in order to ensure that there's sufficient time to engage on the detail. The team will support in the kind of answering of the questions that members may have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Members, what we are looking at here now is over to yourself there, and anyone else who's walked in, you're very welcome. So we have the Honourable Van der Westhuizen, the Honourable Hadebe, the Honourable Kotsi, the Honourable Marais. Is that it there at the moment? Fine.
Thank you, Chairperson. For the other people, the Chairperson knows that we're getting some visitors at about 10 o'clock. And I ask for permission just to leave you after that for a short while to see them off. Chairperson, to the DG, I see that the intended budget for this year of the DTI shows a decrease in the nominal value of that. Now, for me, and surely for you, even more so, this is disturbing in the sense that one would think that in times of economic recovery that the DTI should get a far bigger slice of the cake. Now, my question is, can you just quantify, does that decrease reflect the expenditure of those entities that are going to be transferred to the Department of Economic Affairs, or is it a real decline in your available money to support? And then especially if we're serious with IPAP, we've heard this week that we really need to kickstart something. It's all good enough to have new plans, but you need to really to be able to give serious funding to that, even if you taper off the funding later on. And yet it seems to me as if your scope of being able to do this is seriously limited. And I would like just to get your comments on that then, please, Chair.
Honourable Hadebe.
Thank you, Comrade Chairperson. First of all, I'd like to appreciate the presentation which is before us here. And then again, thank the department for the good work they're doing, because from the public consultations which we are having now, I think across the board, it comes very strongly that the department is very consultative. It is having its ear on the ground. That one is highly appreciated. But from the very same presentations, again, public consultations, there are serious challenges which are coming out, which are put on the door of the department. The first one which I'll speak about will be the issue of the website of the department itself. Say that the website of the department itself is not user-friendly. Take for example, when these guys are doing exports, when they have to get to the figures and facts of the European Union plus the Americas, where we know very well that they're distorting the world economy, you find that this blank, that blank space is there. And they have to pay a lot of money to get that information. So I think that the department must do something around that. And then number two, with the issue of the monitoring of the implementation of the agreements that we make. Take, for example, we are within SACU, a small country like Swaziland, was able to stop the import of flour from South Africa. And nothing has been done simply because there's no tribunal within that. Within SACU itself. So it means that if a small country like Sweden can strangle our exporters, what can the European Union do in the process? And then the other aspect will be the issue of the dispute resolution mechanism of the WTO. There's also an Accra that South Africa does not defend its people. Take, for example, other countries are able to take the big power set on. So when is that capacity going to be developed within the department so that we are able to take that thing to timelessly? And then on the issue of the broad-based economic empowerment, there's a new phenomenon which is coming out in South Africa, the phenomenon of tenderpreneurs, whereby the people become millionaires without even working. What is the department doing about that? Because really, if we are not going to support the people in the production part of the economy and then just go on the tendering part, then we are going to destroy enterprise development.
Are there any regulations the department is putting in place so that it can nip that tendency in the bud? Because if we don't do that, it means that the future of our country is going down the drain. I'll rest the Comrade Chairperson and I'll come back later in the next round.
Thank you very much. Honourable Kotsi? Okay. Thank you, Chair. Chairperson, some few questions that I want to ask from the Minister and perhaps the Department. There was a mention of a clothing and textile industry, a new support package. It would be of interest for us to see that package and perhaps to see how we can revive this industry. During the week, some of the input on the industrial policy, we heard that industries that have fallen down, it is unlikely that they will emerge again. So we need to be convinced, based on the package that exists, that will really revive that. And this week, we also heard that there's more of these industries closing down. The TDVX one in Atlantis, where we know that at some stage there were 2,000 jobs there, and today there's none, and how the department is actually hoping, while we talk about creating jobs, we're still losing some as we speak, which is really a serious problem. On the EPUB too, many of the industries that are actually going to be creating the jobs that we're talking about are not actually in trade and industry, but in other departments. Perhaps, you know, around that, what is the department doing presently to make sure that those other departments are actually really are going to be part of actually this program, which eventually this department will be accountable for. The issue of the payment to SMMEs, this has been something said very loud and clear, but it seems not only from national level, even from local government, there are municipalities that are actually being put under administration as we speak, and some of them have not paid those SMMEs. And how is that going to be facilitated by the very program that is in the DTI, because these are the industries that at least can sustain on a smaller scale, and perhaps they are able to keep this industries going, rather than big companies that when they close, everything dies down. And it's those ones that actually would benefit. It links up with the tender training issue that was raised by Honourable Member Khadeb, because some of these SMMEs are genuine and doing good work, but are being punished and die because they're not being paid on time. There is no sticking, whether it be province or local government, and sometimes private sector, on payment of these small businesses to keep them going. I am very much interested in the estate agency, which is not reformed, you know, transformed in terms of opening that industry up to a lot of people, especially our young people who want to venture in this. You spoke that there's going to be a reform. We are interested to see how far is that going for now, you know, even if it's not a complete plan. Thank you.
Thank you. Is that your mic still on then for Honourable Van der Westhuizen and all? Thank you. I'm not sure if the Honourable Kotsi has finished, because the mics are going off.
There's one question. The issue of the other, with the economic development
Ibrahim Patel's development. I mean, I am not sure if I missed anything. Have we been briefed about which of the units or perhaps, you know, are actually now falling under this department? I think I read it in the paper. I am not sure if I missed that. I mean, really, I think we need to know which ones now are out of DTI and are now in that department.
Right. You will recall that was on our briefing day as part and parcel of what would simply be assimilated and along with the STRAT plan. But let's just move on to the Honourable Marais.
Thank you, Chair. I've got a few questions, some very simple and maybe some a bit more comprehensive. First of all, the first one, the Investment Protection Treaty with Zimbabwe. How long will that still drag on? Because we know that what we've read in the papers is since the discussions on the treaty, there was a lot of apparent transgressions already. And I think there's a lot of South African investors that is really, really concerned at this stage, and some of them is already going to court about that. So when can we see what, and how will that assist investors? The second one is on the SADC EU IPA process. You've just indicated that you are continuing to engage. What does that imply? You know, what is the plan? What is the strategy? What can we expect? And how will our economy being protected and promoted in that regard? It's just not enough said. Then the other question linked to what my colleague has also spoken about, and that's the budget. Now, if I am correct in terms of the MTEF budget that you've given us, that the industrial development for the next 3 years is just over a billion rand per year, if I'm at the right one, P4. And if I can remember correctly, maybe I'm wrong, and I can be corrected, the commitment to BMW, I think, was over 3 billion rand for 3 years. What was the commitment given to Ford? And I don't know if Volkswagen is also benefiting from that because they've announced a major increase in production and exports. You know, I like to see this has been budgeted for, this is what we're planning to do, and whether there's a shortfall or a surplus in that regard. And if there's a shortfall, how will that be managed and made good? The other thing on the triple BEE. I've got a concern in terms of the gazetting of further charters before the amendments possible amendments to the Act and the alignment to the Preferential Procurement Act hasn't been completed. Because we know, and I've been involved in practicing that in the past, is that you obviously look at your charters, and according to that you do your whole planning and everything. And if that is not in line with the Preferential Procurement Act, it means that charters will have to be amended as well. So is it not really, you know, the wrong way around? Shouldn't we now that we have identified that there's problems and concern areas in the BEE Act to rather, you know, go slowly with that further registration of charters? And we know that what we are addressing now has also been identified as part of the problems why charters cannot be finalized and finished. You know, are we not going to repeat the work in the future again? That is a bit of a concern to me. Then in terms of you've mentioned about the industrial development where you look at strengthening the market standards and you've said, you know, basically protecting us from poor quality imports or poor imports. How are you going to do that? I mean, I've got no problem with the principle, but my concern is how are we going to implement it? I know that part of the problems that we've had in the past was like under-invoicing. But under-invoicing is also a very difficult thing to do because I can sell to you whatever we agree upon. You know, how are you going to monitor that? What standards are you going to put in? What does that imply? Does that imply that, for instance, in the textile industry, that somehow you will set a import parity price? And that anything below that will still pay the normal duties, or
or are you going to look at tariffs? What is the intention in there? Madam Chair, I will probably ask further questions later on. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Minister. There's just a couple on the strategic plan on the first place about the monitoring and evaluation with respect to incentives. When it's got how that would be done, we're simply talking about implementing and monitoring. It would be useful if we can understand some of the measures that will be adopted in that regard. The other issue is with respect to what you referred to yourself, trying to get out of the silo mentality across government and even business, for that matter. And when you hear that with fleet capitalization and the promotion in that regard, it becomes very, very clear that as we sit here, that kind of mentality continues to operate, because some of the issues that come up is the constraints that insufficient notice puts on planning. Unless a person, someone on the floor, as it were, a firm, an entity, gets sufficient lead notice, it is impossible to get the structure and the tools in place to develop or to build whatever it is that is required. And then these things are being purchased from overseas. The last point is related to the Honourable Coetzee's point of just being able here and there, although we are not finished with things like IPAP, but also if we could get some understanding through the budget and through the strategy plan as to what entities we would be directly involved in. They do have a TRC in the strat plan, and if you study the budget, I know we do have it there as well. But just a broad outline in that regard.
Okay, I'll start off and take some and then hand over, and some of the things I'll say will, I'll ask for further details, including the first one. I'm going to say a couple of comments on the budget. Just to say that I think you know the broad context that we have a deficit of over 7%. And in that context, the agreement of the Cabinet was that we would fund some programs, but that also every department would have to look for economies within itself. So things like the wage increase that was already agreed in the bargaining council is not fully covered in terms of the allocations. We have to find that in savings. So that's part of the story. I think you'll find that the major funding programs under the IPAP, namely the Automotive Production Development Program and the Clothing Incentive, are actually covered. We did get that through. And that sort of accounts for, so we had some increases there, but we're operating like every other department in that context. And I think part of the story is also explained by some of the transfer of functions. But I let the DG and maybe the CFO's office let you know some of the details on that. I think we'll, you know, just maybe the COO will want to talk about the website, not user-friendly. I'm aware of that. I'm aware that the website is sometimes down. I'm aware that there are problems with the website. There's problems with the call centers. I did mention that. So we do need to improve those services, and that was one of the tasks we gave to the COO. So maybe she wants to talk a little bit more about that. The agreements that we have, you know, the SACU does actually allow for agricultural products to be withheld during the season. There is that exception in the SACU agreement. But having said that, I think that there are some really, really big debates that we have tried to raise in SACU, and I think which we're going to have to reflect on as we come into this 100 years of this organization. And these are about whether we have enough common ground in terms of the way we see economic development, trade, and the customs union to move this thing forward. We think it could move something forward beyond a customs union to take on some of the characteristics of an economic union. I think that's a really, really open question. I think that crops up probably most starkly, and I would suggest maybe you want to watch this, in terms of some of the industrial development objectives and some of the support programs you want to have.
I'll come on and discuss the clothing and textile incentive program in a minute, but I think there's a really harsh issue there. We do not think that the duty credit certificate model has worked. We think the duty credit certificate model where you export, you get a credit, you can then take this credit and you can then sell the credit to anybody else you like, has undermined the industry. So we have had these duty credit certificates sold to importers, retailers, importers, and it's been used to undermine the local industry. So we are not in favor of that, and you'll see the architecture of the new scheme is completely different. Unfortunately, we don't have concurrence with our partners in SAKU over that. I think those are the kind of issues that I think we need to really be talking and debating about, because we are supposed to be moving into an arrangement where we're going to have common setting of tariffs. What is the basis? How do we understand tariff policy? How do we understand the measures that we're going to have in place? And I think that we put this challenge to SAKU, and Nimrod and the team have been talking about how we see industrial development. There are some big debates about the future incentives on the SAKU-wide basis for the clothing and textile industry. All of those kind of issues, I think, are really, really big questions that mean that how we work in this organization is a really big question. I don't want to go into any more than that at this stage. We could have a further discussion on SAKU if you wanted a full briefing on SAKU, but I think there's some very, very big questions here. I mean, I think also maybe David can talk about the dispute settlement mechanism for the WTO. I don't know that there are so many issues where we think that jurisprudence would actually help us in South Africa. And in fact, it's quite a costly process where that happens. But, you know, I think it is a fairly new development where countries like Brazil have started using this, and I think they've been using it very effectively. I'm sure we're monitoring that. And I would suggest that if there is a case where we really could make some headway, where the cost of the litigation would be more than offset by the benefits we'd achieve, we wouldn't hesitate to use the DSM. But at this point in time, I don't think that cost-benefit calculation has crossed our minds. The question of the tenderpreneurs, well, you know, this is one of the issues which we're asking the council to debate. I think that there's this question of fronting in BEE, which we all know about. And I think that we need to address at least three forms of fronting. And the first one is the one we all know, where some company purports to be a black-owned company, but it's actually not. And so what they do is they take someone who's really a junior in the company, they call them the CEO or whatever, and they don't actually do the job of the CEO. That's the fronting that we all know, and that's the fronting that we need to combat. That's straight-out-and-out fraud. That's the first one. Then the second one, which I think is where tenderpreneuring comes in, is that you're actually not really able to do an engineering contract, let's say. You're actually, all you can do is apply for the tenders. And when you get the tender, what you do is you go out to the white-owned engineering company and get them to contract for you, subcontract for you, and then you add on a percentage and you charge government more. I think that's also a form of fronting. We need to understand it's a form of fronting, and I think we need to work so that actually we discourage people from developing expertise only in the filling out of tender forms, and we encourage them to develop expertise in, let's say, engineering or whatever it happens to be. That's the task that I think we need to confront. The third one would be to add to the tenderpreneuring would be what we call in the IPAP import fronting. Instead of going to the local white company to do the job, you import the stuff from somewhere else at the expense of local production. I think those you know, we need to look at this fronting thing in this broader way. We put that challenge to what do we do about it? I mean, we want to increase access of BE companies through the tender process, but we want it to work so that we actually develop real skills and capacities in productive activity. That's a challenge. I don't pretend to have all the answers at this point, but I think we identified that as a major challenge and something that we need to confront as we move forward. The clothing support package. We have actually practically finished all the regulations and terms and conditions on which it will be available, and it comes into effect when the financial year starts in the 1st of April, the new incentive scheme. The basic architecture, I think we probably indicated to the committee before, is we are saying that this DCC thing doesn't work. Another of the problems in the industry is that we have found that there's a lack of investment in new equipment, in even altering labor processes to make them more competitive. That's the problem we've discovered. We've got a phenomenon in the industry which is called sweating assets. You run the machinery until the machinery breaks down irretrievably, then you just close the factory and sack all the workers. So that's the problem. So what we're saying is we're building on what we've got in the automotive investment scheme. We will give a support based on the value added that you produce. So you calculate your value added, sales minus cost of production, value added. And then basically, there's a calculation of value added. You will get a percentage of the value added. You will bank in the IDC a credit. When you've earned enough, you'll be able to draw on that credit for an investment or for a productivity improvement. Not for a second house in Plettenberg Bay, for that purpose only. And our calculation is telling us, and this is also the work of the CSP, everybody else, that that's the biggest problem. And that if our industry is able to position itself right, if we can get the level playing field that they require, not only can we save jobs in the clothing and textile industry, particularly clothing, we can grow jobs. That's what our research is telling us. So we think, we know this industry's bled like mad. But we think that if we get that scheme in place, working properly, we get some real productivity increases, some real new investment, that we can actually grow employment in the clothing and textile industry. Myself and Minister Patel, we were out at Atlantis the other day, and we went to the TEDx factory. And the first time we heard that they were going to close the factory was when we walked in the door. That factory, along with some other television manufacturers, came to us last year, and they said that they need a rebate from the duty. The duty they said they're happy with, the only thing they need is the rebate. We went through a process and we agreed on a rebate, and the issue became, was the definition of those eligible for the rebate to be a population of circuit boards, i.e. you add things into the circuit board and everybody else is a screwdriver operation. Then we had a huge debate. We discovered there were other kinds of companies, and we finally got an arrangement in place. And we gazetted that before the end of last year. Then I heard some of them were going to go to court because they said they had the same firms that were asking us to do the rebate. They've got TVs on the waters coming for the Christmas sale. And they didn't think we were going to get our rebate in place before Christmas, so they were going to take us to court. So I said, I'd love to see a court that's going to say that we should be penalized for doing our work on time. We did our work. And then, without ever coming to us again, we then had walked into the door and heard TEDx was going to close. We said to TEDx, think again and come and engage us. Tell us what else you need, because last time we met, the only thing you said was the rebate and everything else is fine. Let us engage on this and see what we can do. So we're trying to say, don't take the decision to close the factory. Come back to us with a set of proposals. I might add that one of the other things we heard is there's a broader discussion in Atlantis. I gave them a little presentation on what we were doing in the IPAP. I said, no reason why Atlantis shouldn't actually get some of these industries that we do, green industries making inputs into the infrastructure program, and so on and so forth. And they said, no, that's fine. But the problem is that we have to apply to the municipality for authorization for municipal land. It used to take 3 months, now it takes 18 months. That's what they said. We'll draw that to the attention of the municipality of the province. We've done that already. But it's not our call. But that's what a number of the other members of the business community were there. That's what they told us was their biggest problem in Atlantis. So I think we should just take that one on board as well. But we are trying to work to see what we can do for TEDx. I mean, you're quite right that the IPAP depends on government working together as a unit. Quite right about that. In fact, if you look at the action plans, you'll see lead department, other departments, and so on and so forth, and it's a variety. It's not all DTI. And that's been one of the biggest problems in the past, has been to get everybody working together. I don't want to say, I'm not going to say which ones, but there are, if you look very carefully, you can look again and you can see that there are things, one or two things, in the more minor parts of the IPAP 2 that were there the same in the IPAP 1. The reason they're back there in the IPAP 2 in exactly the same way is because some other government department hasn't managed to do its job. That's what it is. That's the reality. Now, this is why we're going to a different structure in government. I can't make any real announcements, but the cabinet system is going to be changing so that we have structures in place for implementation. That's the proposal on the table through the monitoring and evaluation mechanism. Going to put us all together and say, what are the implementation barriers? Why are you not being able to do this? That sort of mechanism in place is going to force us to work together. We're all going to have to combine and accept not just output targets of the sort that we've got down here in the strat plan. We're actually going to have to deliver on outcome targets. We're going to have to deliver quite ambitious outcomes in terms of growth, in terms of employment absorption, and in terms of inequality reduction together. And that's going to require us all to work together. So I think that's the sort of way we want to work now. On the payments to SMMEs, let me just say that, again, somebody might want to add on that. It is already against PFMA regulations not to pay SMMEs in 30 days. It's already that. And, in fact, what's going to happen is that as we move further forward, there will be audit consequences for municipal structures, provincial government structures or national government structures that don't pay on time. There will be that. So that's going to be the way it works. What we have done is we have set up an SMME hotline, which is to try to facilitate whatever we can. We've got from most of the entities in government, I'm not quite sure what the picture is right now, but there were a few who haven't. Most entities in government have identified a point person. Now, somebody phones up the hotline, we've got a problem, then we can start a dialogue to try to resolve the problem. That's the service that we offer at the DTI. But if you just don't pay, then you will get an audit consequence in your audit report. But sometimes we need to just be aware that there can also be two sides to the story. An SMME will come to you maybe and say, I haven't been paid, and the entity concerned will say, we haven't done the work. So, you know, sometimes there are some issues like that, but just non-payment is something which is contrary to the PFMA. On the estate agency, I think somebody can talk about that, but I think the issue is that the estate agency legislation which we have and the role of the estate agency board is almost entirely around consumer protection. So it's around protecting consumers, people involved in contracts and so on and so forth, and making sure that the estate agents pay into a fund so that, you know, if there's a crash of an estate agent, the consumer doesn't lose. The transformation of the estate agency industry, I think, is something which is a fairly new direction, but it's something that we, I think, do need to engage with. Let's accept that is a challenge. I did say which units were going to EDD, actually, when I spoke. I said it's the competition authorities, the IDC, Kula, and SAMAF, and then that there is still a discussion about us having co-responsibility for ITAC, International Trade Administration Commission. That was what I did say there. The Zimbabwe Investment Protection Agreement, I can just say that we would anticipate in a very, very short space of time. I can't quite give you a beyond that, but I mean the work has been done. In a very, very short space of time, that will be tabled into Parliament, our Parliament, and then our Parliament will have to ratify. I'm not sure on the other side, because the agreement doesn't come into force until 30 days after it's been ratified by both Parliaments. So they did tell me when we were up there that they were very keen to get it done expeditiously, and I can't give you an indication there. But it will only come into force 30 days after. Now, once it comes into force, I mean, what has happened is that you've had a few individuals in Zimbabwe, a few cases that have emerged from people that realize that this thing will have legal consequences and that certain actions will not be able to happen after it comes into force, that tried to jump the gun. That did happen over Christmas time, and we had the irony that the very same people that tried to interdict us to prevent us from signing it we're now rushing to say we must come and put it, we must now implement it, even though it actually isn't entered into force. So we had a bit of an irony there. But when it comes into force, those things will not be possible any longer insofar as South Africans are concerned, South African property is concerned, and I think as the DG was indicating, it will create the conditions for a number of South African companies to go and invest in Zimbabwe, and there were a number of them that went up and indicated that they were keen to do so when the agreement comes into force. So I think that will be an important thing. And I think we've taken the view that the more there is a normalization in the economic field, I think the better it's going to be for Zimbabwe. But also, I indicated when I spoke there, I happened to be deployed to Worcester as an MP, and one of the places in Worcester is Duduans. And you know what happened in Duduans? Some labor broker brought thousands and thousands of people down to Duduans. The farmers and everybody said, no, these are much better workers than the locals. They displaced the locals, and we had a very unfortunate incident. And I went to go and speak to those people who were sitting in a camp there on the sports ground, and I said to them, if the conditions existed in Zimbabwe, would you go back? And they said, yes. And when we were in Zimbabwe, I said to the Zimbabweans, we think this is a good agreement for you because it will help you to get your country on its feet again. It's also a good agreement for us because we cannot sustain all these people in our country. We need to create the conditions for them to return to Zimbabwe as part of the normalization process. So I think that agreement will be before you in the short run. On the SADC EU EPA, what's happening? Well, you probably know there's been some changes in the European Commission. There's a new commissioner in place. His name is Karel de Gucht from Belgium. Cathy Ashton, who used to be the commissioner, is now the foreign policy chief and co and what's called vice president of the commission in this new arrangement. Commissioner de Gucht is I was told by the ambassador a few weeks ago, has been in a steep learning curve. He's just taken over. However, he did write a letter saying that he was committed to carrying on with the work that Commissioner Ashton had done to try to bring about a better climate for the continuation of the negotiations. We have met with SACU, we have met with SADC EPA, and we are going into the negotiations in another round at technical level in the near future, where we are putting issues as a package together. The first one is there are some technical issues around alignment of the tariff regime of the Trade and Cooperation Agreement and then the SACU EPA as pertains to entry of EU products into the customs union. That alignment is necessary. It's called retrofitting in order to ensure that there are not different terms of access into the customs union. We have raised the question that must cover rules of origin as well. Can't just be about tariffs, it must be a rules of origin. There's also the outstanding issues that we call them, outstanding negotiating issues. Some agreement on some of them at Throckelpunt with Baroness Ashton, but there's still a number of others that remain outstanding. We are saying that there must be progress across all of these fronts in the next negotiating agreement. And we are saying that we think that those are the priorities. We will see how it goes. We'll see how it goes. At the very least, through this process, we hope that we can minimize what potential damage could be caused to the coherence of SACU. And then we'll have to see, because of South Africa, we have the Trade Development Cooperation Agreement in, we'll have to see whether this package looks better or worse and make a judgment in due course when we see where that process takes us. But that's where we are. In the automotive investment scheme and BMW, Ford and whatever, I think I'll just let Nimrod then speak about the details, but the automotive investment scheme allowance, AIS, the allowance there, which we pretty much finalized the terms there. What you get is you get 20% of the qualifying investment, which is not necessarily the whole thing, 20% of the qualifying investment, and then there's another 10% which can be added if you meet additional targets in terms of employment, in terms of local production, and so on. so it can go up to 30%, so it's not the the full value of the investment. And that could also be available in the form of cash grant and also duty credit. So there's a mix there. I think that we are reasonably confident that we have a budget to cover most of the likely investments. I mean, we are aware of the ones that that are on track, and we have been engaging, of course, with the industry. So we're not completely in the dark about those. It's not that we made a guess and now suddenly tons and tons of extra ones are coming on board. But I think we can let Nimrod add to that. I think the question of gazetting of charters, well, I think there's millions of them in the pipeline. But basically, the charters have to conform to the codes. If there are going to be, I think what we really want to achieve is we want to achieve in BEE, and this is the debate, we want those parts of the codes which are trying to broaden the impact of BEE, those parts of the code that are talking about purchasing from black-owned small businesses, that are talking about community responsibility programs and things like that. We want to see those things really, really move forward. And the BEE is not so much about shared deals of a few individuals, the same old faces. Whether that will require changes to the codes or not, I think is something which is still open at this point. So, in the meantime, the work goes ahead with charters. Not that there's so many of them. What are we envisaging in terms of standards and cutting and locking out, is the phrase, locking out low quality imports? Well, there is already the national regulator of compulsory speculation, specification. We do need a national regulator of compulsory speculation, but that would fall under another department. Specifications, and what they do is they go around and they say that for this and this and this product, and many of them are automotive components, some of them are electronic goods and things like that, that you have to meet a minimum standard. Those standards are extremely technical, but there's a flow of work that's coming in. They are setting those. And then there is an inspectorate, and that inspectorate goes out and it identifies these goods coming here that don't meet those standards. I went a while ago up in near Pretoria. They had a steamroller and it rolled over, loads and loads of these goods that don't meet these standards. That's what we do. That's what we can do. And we can strengthen and we can push that work further forward. Whether that's an applicable measure in clothing textiles, well, that remains to be seen. But, I mean, the actual specifications are based on safety, consumer protection, and things of that sort. But we are actually destroying quite a number of goods on the grounds that they don't meet the compulsory specifications. And then I think that I more or less covered the point raised by the chair that the new approach of government with monitoring and evaluation is very much, there's a huge pressure to work together as a team and for all of us to be responsible, co-responsible for sets of particular outcomes, not upwards, outcomes. And I think that is, and some of the mechanisms, which I can't read, I mean, it's not my call, it's the proposals of the Minister and the Presidency for Monitoring and Evaluation. Some of those proposals are intended to set up structures in the Cabinet process, which I think will actually require that we all sit together and say, well, what are you doing, what are you doing, what are you doing, and why aren't you doing this, why aren't you doing that, and for us to account to each other. That I think can potentially help quite a lot in getting us to work together. As I say, in the meantime, I mean, the way we're trying to work with EDD is let's just break out of this silo mentality and let's try to have an approach which says that let's share the task and let's work as the same team. Thanks. I mean, let the DG now allocate to answer some of the other questions.
Thank you,
Dr.
Thanks. I suppose maybe I'll ask the CFO's office to clarify on the question on the budget. I see Zoto has just stepped aside on the detail on the estate agency. And maybe, Nimrod and others can come in on other questions. Maybe.
Uh,
Chair, from the Office of the CFO, the question was the decline in the budget expenditure. One will note between 2009 and 2010 that there was the amount that was paid out to Kruger. Well, in the new budget, it's lower, and East London and also the SMEDPs. But in fact, the DTI's budget, although there was an amount of 1 billion rand shifted out of the DTI to the new department over the MTF years, the budget actually, the baseline was actually inflated, not inflated, but they added a few of our programs, which clothing and textile and automotive production takes up the most. But the amount of 3.8 billion was actually added to the DTIs over the MTF years. So in fact, the expenditure looked as a decline, but if one look at the broader picture, the DTIs budget has actually increased to 20 billion, which is 3.8 added to the new for over the new MTF years.
Okay, I think, let me just say that our colleague Tumelo, I think, will give some detail on the auto investments. But I think that, I mean, what's clear, and I'm sure people have noticed this in, you know, in kind of media announcements over the last number of weeks, is that, you know, notwithstanding all the difficulties last year that auto companies were in because of the crisis, that, you know, that under the, in terms of the new program with the automotive investment scheme kicking in, there have been some very, very serious announcements of automotive investments. In some cases, like for instance in the case of Volkswagen, you know, even larger than was originally anticipated. So I think we're starting to see the, you know, the benefits and the results of the new auto arrangement starting to feed through already, but I think Tumelo will give more details on the on the numbers. But I also wanted to add a comment on the question on compulsory specifications and compulsory standards and how those will be dealt with. I think there's a whole range of work that's being identified here. Some of it is the identification, the development of new mandatory standards that are necessary in a whole range of industries. And I think one very important one is the mandatory standard that's being developed that by March of 2011, all new, most new buildings will be required to install solar water heating. So that's a very, I think that's a very important standard that's being developed, and it's also a very, very good example of how the standards work can help to create or resuscitate industries. So I think that's one important element of the standards work. Another is in relation to, and again, this came out in the interactions we had with business and labor in the crisis response processes, when we sat down with a number of members of industry, they were saying that, especially in relation to things like inputs into construction, things like electrical componentry into construction of buildings, plumbing inputs, there are existing mandatory standards that need to be complied with, but it's a municipal function to police those standards, and we all know the challenges that municipalities are under, and the practical reality is that these things are not being enforced at the municipal level. So one of the things that we said is, look, we will move towards a situation where certain standards we move to pre-border enforcement. So in other words, it's not the case that the products enter the market and they don't meet with the standards, and then we need to come and police them after the fact, or ask municipalities to do that on top of all the other functions and obligations, but that there are certain products which we, you know, which for practical purposes we actually need to move to pre-border enforcement. So I think one important area of work here is establishing those mechanisms for pre-border enforcement with those types of products.
Thanks. I think Minister has already given an outline of how the scheme works. Companies the new automotive investment scheme, the way it works is that companies that make an investment will qualify for between 20 to 30% of the qualifying investment in machinery and assets. And we do define what assets will qualify. In order to qualify, there are certain requirements around the volume, around employment, and in the case of 30%, around R&D, around local procurement, and so forth. Now, in terms of disbursing the funding to the companies, that does not happen in 1 year. It happens over a period of 3 years, and during that process, we monitor whether the conditions attaching to the approval are being met. In terms of the budget, we've been working quite closely with the industry. We do have the numbers in terms of because it's a fairly smallish industry, especially on the assembly side. The component side might be a bit bigger, but we do have an idea of what are the investments that are going to be coming and in what period. So we have an idea of what is going to be the disbursement. And in terms of the budget, in the last for the MTF period, we've got about 3 billion rands or 2.7 billion rands. We think that it is sufficient given the investments that are going to be coming. We have worked on those numbers.
Thank you, Tiji. Thanks, Minister. Just to add on what the Minister has already said about the estate agents review, we already have a policy framework that has been finalized. It has been consulted with the industry and the stakeholders, and it will go through to Cabinet and through to this committee. And we are in the process of then drafting the bill itself, which will also be piloted through this committee in due course. I must say that the aspect of transformation is very key to this. I think if you talk about figures, for instance, you know, if you look at the number of estate agents in that industry, if you talk about black, Indian colored, you've got about 5% in that industry. If you include Asians, you've got up to like 11%. And this is one of the industries that is highly untransformed. And the current regulatory framework doesn't give us an opportunity to actually put in place mechanisms that will encourage that through regulating that industry properly, because we're still operating on the 1976 Act, which is why we're reviewing the whole framework. And in doing that as well, we're also consulting with the Ministry Human Settlement to see what aspects of that area should sit within that area. And those negotiations are also taking place. But by the time we pilot the policy and the draft bill here, they would be sorted out, and we will allow Parliament also to guide us on that. To add on just the one aspect that the Minister has also touched on is the era of the rules of origin. Members will recall that when we did the Consumer Protection Act, we specifically included provisions to deal with that aspect, to look at the issue of product quality and also standards in relation to products. And one of the things that we've done recently is to do some pre-inspections in some of the retailers in Cape Town, KZN, Eastern Cape. And what we found is that people would actually think that mega retailers are actually complying with the rules of origin and they're putting labeling, but actually it is, I think it's a smoke screen in a sense. Because what happens is that the majority of the products that you find in the retail outlets are actually products that come unlabeled, and there are warehouses that are specifically created to label them. They employ people to do the labeling, so they're being labeled in the country. So you may see that when you buy an item, the labeling and everything is there, but actually it doesn't comply with the rules because they do not come labeled from where they're supposed to be coming from. So that's the area that we now will be focusing on, and we'll be engaging with the SARS as well as the SAPS to assist us in conducting some measure rates to go and target the very same warehouses that have been identified during this process. Thank you.
you very much. Members, we are going to take a second bank, and then when we've had the questions, we're taking a 10-minute tea break. I know people like to close early on a Friday, so that's why we're doing it this way. So let's have the questions, starting off with the Honourable Marais. Any other questions, Honourable Njikalana, Honourable Kobasa, Honourable Kotsi, and Honourable Khadebe? So we make a note of those.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Obviously, on the automotive program, I haven't had the response on in terms of that quantification of BMW, Ford, Volkswagen, and how much has been allocated to each of them over a three-year period, you know, because we've only got a billion rand available per year. I don't know if I must put that in a written question, but I haven't been answered in that one. The other one is on the industrial development zones. If you could just refresh my memory in terms of which are the industrial development zones that we have. I know it's Kuga and it's Richards Bay, probably. And I don't know whether there's East London as well. But then isn't there a plan to expand that? Atlantis is a very good example, which can be an industrial development zone. Saldanha can be one. So there can be various ones. I know there's some preconditions for such a zone in terms of access to exports, railways, harbours, roads, etc. Is there any plans in that regard? Then the development outcomes in Doha. You're saying that you are pursuing that, and that's wonderful. But we've discussed it many times in our committee as well, where we said, you know, we don't know whether that is of really value. We've also heard that during the public hearings on IPAP, that the perception is that it's an ongoing talk shop, and that some countries might oblige abide by that rules or arrangements. Others just don't, and it seems like nothing is happening because they are China, or because they are America, or because they are Korea. Or India, big players. So if you can give me more information with regards to, you know, what can we expect, when, you know, or is it just really a talk shop? The other thing, the last point is just on the IDC, and I know that the Minister has said that we must, you know, move away from this silo thinking, but I've always perceived the IDC as being very, very, very important for industrial development, and it was quite surprising to me to see that, you know, the IDC has been moved out of DTI to economic development, and it implies that either they're going to lose Nimrod or we're going to lose Nimrod. So, because if I'm correct, Nimrod is currently on the board of IDC. Correct, eh? Yeah. So just the rationale behind that as well, please. Thank you very much.
Where we were employing well, but carry on. Honourable Kotsi? Honourable Njikalana?
Thanks, Chair. Chair, just as a comment first, you know, it seems the Atlantic case is a very interesting one, given that we also have paid Atlantis a visit. The input from the minister is actually quite instructive and educative for us in terms of our work, you know, as to what we have done and the impact thereon. And I really commend the follow-up that has been made by the minister on the area. Another comment is around the advisory council. Last year although I missed the meeting, but I know from the committee there was unhappiness about the junior person who was sent to make a presentation, and I hope both the minister and the DG will take note of that. I'm sure Baba Matuna must have just assigned someone to say, please go and look after this, but
I repeat, we are very, very unhappy because we are quite sensitive. And, you know, our keenness on, small business empowerment. The question now is around, just strategically on linkage with rural economic programs. I know we've got a department of on rural economy, but I'm still quite keen. I've been raising this even in the past, but to what extent is the department looking at linkages with the Department of Rural Development, but strongly from the economic side? And, of course, we've got PIPAP, too, which has become a flagship, tool when it comes to the, economic transformation, essentially. The other area I'm keen on, I know, Chair, I'm speaking with some apologies because I disappeared for a few minutes, on empowerment and enterprise development, division. I must say, just personally, I'm unhappy or anxious or uneasy about the amount, the budget allocation, but even before I conclude that conclusively, it might be helpful just to have a sense as to what is the overall investment or resource allocation there, because one is also quite aware that, putting 777 million maybe just budget allocation, there could be other, areas of investment that are done, in and around the area. So is there a way of giving us, a comprehensive picture, maybe not even necessarily today? The other area is that we're still talking about the recovery. And, Chair, I'm just raising that. I know we've had it in the past, but it might be helpful that we also have another timing as to when are we going to have another round whereby we have just a comprehensive update on the on our recovery program, the effect it has. But in this way, in this instance, Chair, can I be ambitious and say, let's try and pull in other departments and portfolio committees so that we have a cluster ideas to the extent of how other departments, have pulled together on the economic recovery. Another area is the SQUAM, community. Given that we've got a strong focus on SQUAM as well in the context of the IPAP 2, I was looking at the regional context as well, because the more we advance, the greater is the challenge if our neighbors in SADC are left behind. So I'm just provoking that how is the department preparing for that risk? I see it as a risk, Chair, because if SQUAM advances because of IPAP, and we leave our neighbors behind and would like to have regional economic integration, there is some wobbling somewhere there because of the uneven development. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Just poll for Lay High School is just popping in to observe for a while. This is the grade 12 history class, and their history teacher, I believe, a Mr. David Sayer. Is that right? You're very welcome. Thank you for being here with us this morning. This is Trade and Industry, and sitting right in front of you is the Minister and his team, the Minister of Trade and Industry, Dr. Rob Davies, and on your right, and the Deputy Minister who's just got her head down there, the Deputy Minister Mantuli there, who's the Deputy Minister of Trade and Industry, and on my right is the committee itself. Certainly one of the people who brought you in is also a member of this committee, the Honourable Van der Westhuizen. You're very welcome. This ministry has two deputies, one deputy, the Honourable Tandy Tobias, is not with us this morning, Macaulay. So it's back to the committee meeting. Always good to have high school and two or three people here who, so that they can see how Parliament runs and engages with the executive. Honourable Corbasa.
Thank you, Chairperson. My first question is around the Doha round of negotiations. Chair, given the difficulties in the process, but yet there seems to be an attempt at hastening the conclusion of the Doha round of negotiations at the expense of the developmental agenda. What alternatives, or perhaps if you like, what scope exists for concluding this round of negotiations without compromising the developmental agenda? Secondly, Chair, I heard the Minister responding to the question of the budget. But allow me to ask the question, because I'm not sure what question was asked. So, at the risk of the chairperson slashing my throat for answering the same question, let me do so. If you compare the budget, for instance, 2007-2008 up to 2013, there is a steady increase in the budget. One would have expected a significant increase given, you know, the imperatives of implementing EPUB 2. Could there be any explanation for you know, that kind of steady increase instead of a marked increase accommodating that? But that leads me to the third question, Chairperson, and the last one. Is there a consideration, perhaps, of taking the old question of EPUB and its funding to NEDLAC to solicit consensus on particularly funding of EPUB, of the implementation of EPUB, especially investment by the private sector in the productive sectors of the economy as targeted by EPUB? Thank you, Chairman.
Kotsi. Thank you, Chair. Chair, there has been an outcry from a number of inputs we got from the EPUB, and it's something that goes around among South Africans as well. The volatility of the rand exchange rate. I know it is not the responsibility of this department alone, but it would be interesting to do it, because if you talk investment, that does affect this volatility, does affect that as well, if we want to create those jobs and bring investment into the country. The issue, there's a talk as well of sometime soon we might be heading for another economic recession. And perhaps for the department, because we know what it has done now, even though it did not catch us too bad, but we are, what means, you know, are we, what effort are we putting to make sure that the impact is not felt seriously, if we may, or maybe try and cap some other matters that perhaps we could as a country. There's a strong feeling that we need to be, and I know the minister mentioned this earlier, that people import rather than going to local company, even if they are white, to source there. What does that say? I mean, what negative impact does that have in terms of us being part of the global world, which means then that these other countries perhaps might find that they catch us somewhere in terms of in terms of a business, because if we do that, they might decide that, you know, as we are also part of the World Trade Organization, maybe catch us somewhere where perhaps they punish us as a country. What balance are we putting around that? I read some other document on something that in South Africa we are good at in terms of, again, I'm coming to clothing. They were saying that South Africa is one of the countries that export some of the best bulletproof. How do we, such products that we think as South Africa we are best at, perhaps take more mileage around producing those and actually approaching a number of countries and sustaining those jobs, in fact increasing them in those areas where we are best, and that could be done best by the intervention of government in terms of growing or maybe expanding that area in terms of sustainable jobs. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Khadeb.
Thank you, Comrade Chairperson. I'm very happy to hear that the minister is the MP for Worcester, because I heard that during the commission's public hearings in Worcester, only 6 people who turned up for that. Seemingly, it was not properly advertised. I'd like to appeal to the department to ensure that that round is set again. They go back to Worcester and then properly advertise, even in the other areas, so that they can also give the times when the commission is going to sit. Because I saw the press release, it does not give the times. It just gives the venues where it is, but the times is not there. If we can rectify that as quick as possible. Yeah. And then on the issue, I just would like to concur with Honorable Njikalana on the issue of rural development. We know that we had, former President Thabo Mbeki had these nodal points, which were economically depressed areas. So what is the focus of the department doing to really stimulate economic development around those areas in a larger scale, seeing that even the APAP says that we have to deal with agro-processing and all those things which can be done in those areas. And then number three will be the issue. I'd like to appreciate the attitude taken by the department, in particular concerning the integration of SADC. That is going to be the developmental type of the situation. But what I'm concerned about is the issue of the Cape to Cairo free trade area. I think it's a little bit dangerous, because if you can look at the other free trade areas like the European Union, you find that those people have got a lot of resources to defend their union. They have the capacity, they have the infrastructure, they have the technology to do that. In Africa, are we going to be able to do that? Because eventually, as I know, a lot of things around Africa, they will eventually revert back to South Africa as a country to see to it that it goes through. Now, are we, as South Africa, going to be able to ensure that there's compliance about this free trade area, starting from SADC? I know even SADC itself is going to end up as our bond, as South Africa. So when we include the whole of Africa, if you have gone to Bujumbura, I was surprised. You declare that area a free trade area. I don't know what controls are going to put in place in order to defend this thing. So is the department really ready to be able to engage in such a massive, big scale with so much big competitors? Because I know that the Americans are already interested in that, so that they can go in, so that, because it's difficult to get through South Africa, they can go through the other areas. Thank you.
Right. The other thing, Minister, is... can you share with us perhaps what had influenced Elcan, that's if you know, to withdraw its investment, and what impact is this going to have on the critical infrastructure program? The second thing is, on the actual critical infrastructure program itself, what model is being used to ensure that its impact, its intended impact, does shift down? I don't like using the word trickle down. I got so fed up with trickle down economics years ago. To downstream industries. Thank you. Now, honourable members, this is the 5 to 10 minute tea break, so that we are able to close earlier. So let's take it now and bring our tea back. It's now 10 to 11. it's time being here at 11 or 5 past is the latest.
I mean, many more of the questions, including like the first one of Mr. Maria about how much to each of the companies or whatever, that I'll ask other people to answer, so I'll take less of them this time. First of all, on the IDZs, it's just to say that we do have quite a lot of issues around the IDZs. First of all, there's a question of the governance of the IDZ, and there's a proposal of new legislation which is still under discussion around the clarification, what is the role of national provinces, local governments even, and then also the particular boards of those IDZs. And then there's a broader question. I mean, I know that Saldana has submitted an actual proposal, and we'll have to discuss that and also discuss that in the framework of the MINMEC arrangements. But we do need to understand that IDZs are for particular kinds of economic activities with a high export content. They're not necessarily available to each and every part of the country. So there is another measure which has been discussed, which is called Special Economic Zones, SEZs, and there's more of them and different arrangements that apply to those. But I think there's a much bigger and broader debate which we started at the MINMEC level, but we need to take further forward. And that is, how do we promote industrial decentralization? That we want to do that, I think, is a given. And we need to do it, obviously, to areas of potential, but what is the meaning of that? I think that's also something which needs to come up. And whether it's the mechanisms that we're coming up with are the best or the only ones. And I think that, look, you know, the apartheid spatial development program didn't work. It was highly costly. These other measures probably not achieving enough decentralization. And the question is now, where do we need to move? Now, if we had tons and tons of money, I'd say we need to have something like the European Union regional funds, but we don't have that. So what can we actually realistically develop? I think that's a debate that's still on. And I think the committee is kind of welcome to engage it in further depth at that, some of the ideas that are there. There were two questions on Doha, so let me just try to indicate where we're at. When the developing countries agreed in Doha in 2001 to another round of multilateral trade negotiations, they did on con- did so on condition that, in the words of the Doha Declaration, the needs and interests of developing countries will be placed at the heart of the work program. That was the agreement. Now, we continue to be a demander on that as an outcome. That's what we say. We say we want to see that as an outcome. There are also some other people around, including the Director General of the WTO, who are saying, and got a point, we've been at this thing now for 9 years, and they're now starting to say we must finish it. We are not a demander for any particular time frame to finish this thing. We remain a demander for a developmental outcome. We say the net outcome must be something that delivers a developmental reform of the world trading system, and that means one that changes the balance in favor of developing countries. Unfortunately, we think that much of the end game has been dominated by the reverse, by a series of demands on the part of developed countries for sectional interests, which incrementally are turning the balance away from developing countries, diluting the agricultural reform mandate, seeking to impose unreasonable demands on groups of developing countries, so-called advanced developing countries, in industrial tariffs, upping the ante on trading services, and so on and so forth. And we think that is skewing the imbalance. Well, we stand right at the moment in a huge impasse. At the end of this month, on the 29th or 31st of March, there was supposed to be, according to the proposals which most of the membership agreed actually in November, a review, a stock-taking exercise of where we're at in the Doha process, and the ambition was to have this at ministerial level. Well, because of the dynamics, a sensible decision has been taken that this will now be held at senior officials level. No indication of whether or when there may be some sort of ministerial engagement. All the mandates that have come from the G20 to conclude in 2010 look unlikely to be fulfilled, and the G20 itself will probably have to engage with that issue when it meets in June later this year. Well, that's the reality. I saw in the international press that the Director General and some other representatives of the WTO had been to go and engage in the U.S. Congress, and I think they got an indication that the United States is not ready to engage on the same, not ready to conclude on the same terms as most of the rest of the membership are. That's a reality. They want more. They're not happy with what's on the table, and I think that means that there's no early conclusion likely, and certainly not, I don't believe, in the course of this year. Now, you will recall that in July 2008, there was a ministerial, went on for about 10 days, and there was a small group formed by the Director General, which we think was an imbalanced group. It consisted of four developed country groups, three developing country representatives who were there, and this group worked on a proposal that was supposed to be put to everybody else. They couldn't agree even among themselves, and the meeting broke on that basis. But the framework that was there represented more or less the maximum amount of concession at that stage that the major developing countries were prepared to make on industrial tariffs. They've all said so. But that took them, some of them have said that took them up to the wire on where they could be on industrial tariffs. That they had played all their cards on the table at that stage. The formulas and the numbers that were put in there at that stage was as far as they could go. I've been saying that South Africa, we're on the wrong side of the wire. This situation where we were classified as a developed country in the Uruguay round, and where our bound tariffs are much lower than those of other comparator countries, it means that when you start applying the Swiss formula with the same coefficients as everybody else would get, it means that we would take cuts much bigger on than any other country in the round would take on any other subject, on any subject. And we've won recognition of that. And so there have been various proposals as to how South Africa's specific solution would be reached. Unfortunately, we say we're not there. The numbers and the proposals on the table are not sufficient for us, are not there. So that's where we find ourselves. Our issue is not a major one on the table. A major one on the table appears to be, whether the United States of America is going to receive additional market access from a list of developing countries. Well, we are on that list, additional to what the formula would supply. The list starts with China. We're towards the end of the list. But I think that the impact is quite profound, and that we're not close to any immediate outcome. But what I said just now was this wasn't where we were putting all our effort on the trade front. We were continuing to watch this space. If things develop, we'll play our role. We'll go and play our role. And we'll fight for our corner. And we'll fight to make sure we don't get disadvantaged. And we'll fight more broadly for more of a developmental outcome of the round. And we remain demanders. We can sit and wait. Whenever we get more of a developmental outcome, we'll take it then. We're not in a big rush. Doesn't look like a developmental outcome is on the table anytime soon, and that's the reality that we have to grapple with. On the question of the IDC, let me just say that among the institutions transferred are the IDC and other development finance institutions under the rubric of the DTI, formerly under the rubric of the DTI. The reason for that is that the whole question of development financing and industrial financing through a developmental agency, as you know from the ICAP, is a fundamental one. Are we saying there has to be a major overhaul of the way in which the IDC is working? Not that the IDC has been doing bad work and so on and so forth, but we want the IDC to undergo some important reforms. And the EDD is able to give concentrated, focused attention on that matter. So that's fine. And in fact, we have already made it very clear, Nimrod will continue to serve on the board. So Nimrod is not going to EDD, and Nimrod is not being kicked off the board of the IDC. So you can rest assured on that. Nimrod just regrets the fact that he's serving on the board doesn't mean any additional remuneration to him because he's a public servant. So there. I just want to... I think all the questions that were raised by the Honourable Njikalana, I'm going to leave to other people, except for the one issue which was also raised by Member Kosti on the recovery and the global economy. I mean, let me just say that yes, you know, I think that there's a case for having a more encompassing discussion on this, but I think that the best guess, because that's what it is, everybody who is an expert is guessing at the end of the day, forecasting. But the best guess is that the recovery is extremely fragile, a recovery such as it is, uneven, fragile, with a risk still of double dip. We met with the managing director of the IMF the other day, some of us, and they don't believe there'll be a double dip, but they do believe that the recovery is extremely fragile. And I saw in the newspaper yesterday, World Bank said it takes 10 years to recover. That's what the prognosis looks like. Something like that. Now, we can debate it out and have a guess about it, but I think that looks pretty realistic to me, that sort of thing. The recovery is fragile. What does this say to us, I think, is the important thing. I think what this says to us is that it can't be business as usual for the South African economy. That we can't just say, okay, we'll hope there's going to be a global recovery, we'll just carry on as we were before without addressing some of the structural issues. In fact, this is the point that we'd be making. Even before the recovery, when we were humming along, we were doing the best we'd ever done at any time since the Second World War, we hit 5% growth, we had the longest period of uninterrupted growth for any time since the Second World War. When we were there, we didn't get unemployment below 22.8% of the economically active population. And what this says is it says we need to make structural changes if we're going to address problems of poverty, unemployment, inequality. That's what we've got to do, make structural changes. The fact that the world economy is not likely to suddenly set us all off into a massive boom again adds to the need for us to make those structural changes. That's the point. I think that's the point I want to make. So that's where the IPAC is coming in. Let's say we need to start to make those structural changes. I mean, I think the reality is that
the apartheid growth path, this is how I see it, the apartheid growth path depended on drawing in large numbers of low-paid black males into unskilled employment in the mining industry and in agriculture, the migrant labor system, all of that, and the destruction of productive capacity in the former homelands as part of generating the migrant labor pressures, all of that. That was the model. So large numbers of people were unskilled, low-paid wage workers drawn in into mining. Now, the mining industry, and the gold mining industry in particular, has been past its prime since the mid-1970s, and it's been discarding labor. Unskilled people. First of all, they went back to the homeland. Well, first of all, they threw people out from neighboring countries. Then it was into the homeland. Then when influx control disappeared, some of those people have been coming to the cities. Unskilled people. And this is the problem. This is a structural unemployment problem that we face. And we've got to address that, and address that much more energetically. So the ICAP is just one part of the growth path. But it's a part of the growth path that I would argue is absolutely critical, because it's value-added activities. And even if we grow more jobs in the service sector, the quality of those jobs, the sustainability of those jobs, is going to depend on the productive sectors of the economy. That's the point. So ICAP is trying to make these structural changes, and I think that's the information that we have about the global prognosis, I think, only reinforces the need for us to make these structural changes, because we can't just rely on this. Of course, there was plenty of wisdom, so-called wisdom, I'll put that in inverted commas, that told us before, the world economy is fine, it's going ahead, and all developing countries have to do is just adapt themselves to the global economy, and then suddenly you're going to all end up like China or something. Not a bit of it. And much less so now. Nobody says that anymore, because they don't know anymore. Huge uncertainties about the world economy, and I think that means that we just have to get our own house in order. Then, just on one point that Member Kabati raised. Yes, of course, we will be taking the ICAP to NEDLAC. That's part of the thing that we're doing there. I mean, it's one part of the partnerships that we have to build. We can't deliver ICAP, even if we get government together, without there being an involvement of the private sector. It involves that, and also the labor union. So it will go there. Member Kosti raised, okay, the recession double dip, I've dealt with that. The exchange rate. It's not just the volatility of the exchange rate, it's the competitiveness of the exchange rate. It's the two things together. And I think we indicated in IPAC that's one of the important cross-cutting issues to make this a success. So it's also acknowledged in the budget speech. The real debate is what are we going to do about it? That's the big debate. We would all like, I'm sure, to have a competitive and less volatile exchange rate. In fact, we need it. I mean, we need it. And the discussion debate is how do we go there? And I think that debate is going on, and I don't want to enter into that at this point. But that the exchange rate is an issue, I think, is something which we have to acknowledge. Are we going to be supporting local procurement, local production in ways which are going to create the antagonism from the rest of the world? Well, I think we're not going to do anything that is outside of the WTO. We're not going to do that. But we are not part, and we're not intending to become part of the plurilateral arrangement on procurement. And all of the things that we are proposing, we are confident are within the scope of the policy space that is allowed under the WTO rules, and we will continue to argue that policy space is there. And by the way, those of us who are going to tell us that we shouldn't, ask them whether they practice what they preach. And I think we will very often find that many other countries are also supporting local procurement. And in fact, it makes economic sense. And we tell lots of investors that we're going that way. We tell them, how can we be moving towards windmills, which we're going to be using to produce wind energy, in the name of reducing carbon? And then we're going to put them all on a ship and bring them over here and use carbon doing that. Does it make sense? Not economic. It's not contributing to what we're supposed to be achieving. So we have to manufacture those things here. We have to manufacture at least significant parts of them here. And we're telling companies, foreign companies, you can get involved here as an investor and create local production capacity. And I think many of them understand that. I mean, I've been having meetings all this week with people from European government. I don't know anybody say to me, no, we must let us export the whole damn thing. And I think that is something which is understood, and that's what we'll be doing. And in fact, we need to reduce the import leakage in order to sustain those programs. On the question of bulletproof vests, or maybe we have a niche there, I don't particularly know. I said to Anwar, of course, in the tea time, I don't particularly know about that. But there are niches where we can make progress on clothing textile industries. I didn't mention those. Well, the first one is fast fashion, the ability to respond quickly to changing demands of retailers. That's the first one. And the second one is some specialized camping equipment, sports equipment, that kind of stuff. I mean, firms that are going in those directions are actually making some headway. Now, whether we have a particular niche in bulletproof vest, I don't know. In any case, if we were going to export that stuff, it would be covered by the National Conventional Arms Control Committee. On the Gambling Review Committee, I think we have already indicated to them that they need to go back to the places that weren't properly covered with the notices without the dates and so on, and I think they're ready to do that. But let me just say that what we are trying to do with this Gambling Review Commission is not a kind of an opinion poll study. We're looking for input from people that have got, you know, significant things to add and say to the whole issue. In fact, some work was done by the National Gambling Board, which was more of an impact of gambling, trying to measure the extent of gambling. And I think some of the things that they came up with are really quite telling. And let me just mention three of it. They indicated that they thought we were now a stable, a matured market for gambling, but actually at quite a high level. In South Africa, we are spending more on gambling than we are on cell phones. We are spending almost the same as we're spending on cigarettes, and we're spending about half as much on gambling as we are on all other forms of entertainment together. It's quite a lot. What they haven't done, we've asked them to do it in the National Gambling Council we had last week, and go back and tell us how does this compare with other countries. That's what we need to know. But it's quite a lot. And so the real issue, I think, as you know, is that there are all these proposals, one by one, for us to enlarge gambling activity, that we should move into greyhound racing, that we should embrace all kinds of new electronic forms of gambling, including what's called person-to-person, which would be you have a betting shop around the corner, somebody walks in and says, I think that this cricketer will get so many runs, and the other one says, no, I think you get less than that, and you put it together in this way. I think, it's gambling, it's great gambling, all of that. There are all these proposals that this should happen in South Africa, that we should allow, the bit of an issue we've been having with Gauteng, we've kind of reached the ceasefire, depending on the outcome of the commission, that we electronic terminals, which are pretty much like a betting machine to us, but are called bingo. All that kind of stuff is happening. Now, what we really want to do is, where do we draw the line? Where do we say, this is it, and we're not having all these new things coming in? And by the way, we're going to take action against illegal online gambling that's happening right now. We get an advert from somebody saying, come and, bet in some neighboring country. And I think, just to say that people who think they're going to get winnings from this, and it's going to come through the banking system, they start thinking again. People who think that transactions are going to be actionable in South African law, so that if somebody makes a credit card claim and it's not valid, they better think again. Because, those are the sort of directions we are. We don't want this thing to be happening illegally, and we're going to cut down on people. So I just want to give that warning at this point. On the rural development, I think I'd ask Mark Tully to just talk about that. But yes, we are working with the Department of Ministry of Rural Development. On the question of the concerns that were raised about the Cape to Cairo SDA, I think the concerns about enforcement and the concerns you're talking about really arise when we talk about a customs union, which is one of the reasons that I'm careful about this, why we are wary of the customs union. But the earlier premise of moving to a customs union in SADC, enforcement of a common external tariff, the setting of the common external tariff, the way we would go about this, whether we have enough common understanding about what tariff policy is about, those, I think, all those concerns arise. The free trade agreement, I think, does not really pose those problems in our judgment. In any case, most of Africa will be having some sort of free trade agreement with the European Union under the EPA arrangement. So that if we don't have something corresponding ourselves, then I think we're going to be having a problem in terms of, we may end up trading with Kenya on worse terms with the European Union or something like that. In any case, each of those groupings, SADC, East African Community, and COMESA, will have now each got at least an FTA among themselves, and in some cases, some sort of customs union among themselves. Now, if we extend the same level of market access, broadly speaking, and then we think about some way of adjusting that, I think our judgment is that this is not a problem for us, that this would actually cement and strengthen intra-African trade. Not that every other issue is not important, because when we look at the SADC thing, already the SADC FTA, in 2005 South Africa removed duties on nearly 98% of imports from other countries. Look at the pattern of trade, pretty much what it's always been. And the reason for that is it's the capacity issue. So promoting equitable regional integration, our view, also requires advances in cooperation on infrastructure development, cooperation on industrial development, identification of cooperative arrangements around that, all that kind of stuff. But I think that we don't think that the kind of concerns would arise in terms of that broader arrangement, but I'll let Xavier add to that. And then finally on the ALCAN, I leave the Critical Infrastructure Program, the ALCAN. Just to say that what happened, for those that don't know, is ALCAN, which was planning for some time and negotiating to set up a smelter in Kucha, withdrew about a year ago. And the reason for that was the energy agreement could not be put in place. We don't have the energy capacity in this country, nor can we offer the price discount to support at this stage anyway, new smelters of the kind which are not using even our local minerals. The ones that we have already, the bauxite comes from Australia, gets turned into aluminium, and then in fact the cast house, which was used to produce what's called extrusions, which were used by downstream industries in Richard Bay, is already closing. I mean, we've been intervening on this matter, and we're quite concerned about it, because the local beneficiation from that is put at risk. But mostly these things are exporting this product just going through the use of cheap electricity. We don't have that capacity any longer. And in the end of the day, I think ALCAN understood that, we understood that, and there was a pretty amicable agreement that we would have to put this thing on, at least put it on hold for until the energy situation in the country dramatically changed. Kucha had actually anticipated this for some time. They knew we weren't going to be able to do this. And they were quite laid back. They'd already been making their plans for Kucha on different assumptions. So there's a whole range of different projects which the oil refinery is one of the biggest ones, but not the only one. They've been moving in this direction. So I think that there's no crisis caused for either for about ALCAN, not our business, but no, not for Kucha. I don't think it's any particular crisis caused by the fact that we didn't go ahead with this particular investment in Kucha. But I think if I could just ask the DG to assign the others, so thanks, Minister. The question on the amount for the automotive investment, I would like to further clarify that. And then I think Mansuri will deal with the question as well, the development. And then, of course, I think other things, I mean,
thank you very much, Minister. And thank you very much for the question. On rural development, as a department, we have embarked on the fact-finding mission. We visited all the provinces. We now know what is happening in all the provinces and what are the challenges and the priorities, of course, of the provinces themselves. We'll be issuing a report. I've seen you gave us a date in May, which is a little bit too far for me, but I'll wait for May, but there is a report on that. The Minister talked about cooperatives when presenting the report on the findings and strategies of SMME's development. Now, cooperatives are some of the vehicles that we are going to use in developing rural areas. But if you look at the cooperatives that we are having now, we need to sit down and look at what can we do to strengthen that sector of our industry. Well, what is it that we can do to make them real cooperatives? I used to put it that way, that they are cooperatives, but something is lacking. Now, I also want to touch a little bit on them to say, as a department, we have that cooperative wing, and we are coming up with a document which is ready. If you allow me, I'll also present it together with the report that you are coming with, which it is ready, and we are also coming up with the findings that we have in our report. Let me touch two challenges that are in all the provinces. One is the challenge of skills. How do we train our people? Who must take part? What are our FETs doing as well as our universities? How do we together work towards training real entrepreneurs? I'm always saying you might be a graduate, you might be having some knowledge in a particular sector, but until you are trained as an entrepreneur, you are not an entrepreneur. Now, how do we deal with that? How do we bring all the stakeholders together? How do we bring in the expertise of all the sectors that are there to say, let's come up with a proper training to enable these people to be real entrepreneurs? That's one big challenge that we're having. We can pump in money, we can give them whatever we want, but without proper training, we won't be able to have proper entrepreneurs, sustainable entrepreneurs, if I may put it that way. The second one is funding for SMEs. It is clear that small business people or small farmers are the ones that will participate in the rural development. You won't find investors from anywhere who would like to go and invest in the rural area. You can do what you want, you won't find them, unless you have a huge incentive package, like what was happening in the past. I won't go to that, but all of us know what was happening. We know that people were given incentives, 7 years incentives, especially that other country, Taiwan, let me put it that way. Yes, they used to come and invest for 7 years and get the incentives for 7 years, and after the end of the 7 year period, they move to another homeland to start up in another name, do the same thing, have a different name, get incentives again, stuff like that. So without a huge incentive package, you won't get the investors coming in. But now, what we are saying is that let's train our own people, that we invest in their own area, develop them in such a way that they are sustainable. They can even compete with other investors from outside. Now, the funding part is something that we must look into. I know that we have institutions, the financial, the development financial institutions that we are having. We've cited IDC, FAMA, Kula, NAF. We have many other institutions that are helping. But until we remove the silo mentality that the minister talked about, we are not going to conquer this war of funding small business. Why am I saying this? If we look at each financial intermediary, we find that it is governed by a particular act, and it has got its own regulations, and that one and that one. There's no single system of funding small businesses in South Africa. We don't have that. Until we sit together and say, this is a model that we want to create, that will enable us to fund small businesses, and that will enable us to have somebody accountable, that you haven't done your work, won't be able. For instance, as we are sitting here now, you never challenge anybody amongst the FDIs that we are having, that you haven't done your work, you haven't promoted small business, you won't be able to. So if we remove this silo mentality and say this is the model that we want to have to empower our small businesses, to enable us to develop the rural areas, especially to empower women, because in the rural areas, we all know that the majority of the people that are there are women and children. Now, how do we then empower them to make sure that they create sustainable businesses? Now, we need to say, how do we bring science and technology for technology transfer? We need to say, how do we bring the Department of Education for training? We need to say, how do we bring the agricultural department? Because they also have a cooperative wing. How do we bring in land and rural development for land issues? And until, again, we break the silo of the department working as individuals, I will take a little bit of money to, let me say, Ecofimva. Come with that little bit of money, put up a smaller project. Agriculture will also do the same, but if we combine the effort and work together, we'll be able to create a economic hub somewhere to say, this is what we can do. How do we bring health? How do we bring social services? All those departments should be able to work together to form that big power. What can I say? To enable those people to see a difference in their life. Now, they all have a role to play. It won't assist us to sit here and pretend that the DTI alone will be able to create jobs in the rural areas. It's not possible. And until we start to work together, we are doing a disservice to those communities. Now, Honorable Member Okoko raised the issue of estate agents. That one has got the best, monopoly. They have a monopoly at this time. And not only that industry. You look at what is happening in the panel beating industry. You yourself know very well that you cannot give your car to a backyard panel beater and think that the insurance company will pay it. And you cannot allow your uncle to go and tow your vehicle and take it to a panel beater and think that the insurance company will pay it. It's another industry that we need to penetrate. It's an industry that is monopolized by the towing vehicles, the insurance companies, and the big panel beaters. So there's a huge gap between the backyard manufacturers. What are we doing? How are we taking those people out of the backyard, train them, and make them, enable them to be able to compete with this big, make them a company that you can take your car to and your insurance company will be able to pay those that service that they have rendered to you. It's another industry. And the other one, if we talk about developing rural areas, rural nodes, we look at the agricultural market again. We must address this issue of the market. We know that the big farmers have closed the market for small farmers. They can produce, but they have nowhere to sell. They've created this board, the maize board, the potato board, the citrus board. You name all those boards. They are all created. They are there. If you are a small business person, you can produce as much as you can, and if the prices are down, you'll be bound to sell at that low price and sell at the loss. Then they'll be putting their produce somewhere, waiting for the price to rise, and they will sell at the proper time when the prices are okay. You have sold yours, you have went at a loss, and that's it. You are going down. Now, there are many issues that we need to correct, and DTI alone will not be able to do that. Now, I am saying all the relevant departments should come and work together, and not only the departments, not only the agencies, all of us, because if we talk about rural development and we talk about poverty, it knows no boundaries. I must be in a position to say, okay, the minister has given me this small business sector to deal with, but how do I work with Mrs. Court? How do I work with the honorable member here? What is it that he can give to me that I can make use of and address the issue of poverty in rural areas? Poverty knows no boundaries. Poverty knows no color. So it needs all of us to put our heads together and say, how do we develop this particular area? What are the strategies that we are having in place? Why did the other strategies fail? And what is it that we can put in place that is new, that will enable us to develop those areas? It's a big challenge. Thank you.
May I start to explain the issue of the automatic investment scheme. In terms of the way we do the budgeting, we budget for the industry as a whole and not necessarily for individual manufacturers. So if one looks at the budget of the department, there is a budget of about close to 2.8 billion rand for the automotive investment scheme, and the way it's spread out is 7 million rand in the first year, 916 in the second year of the MTF, and about a billion rand in the last year of the MTF. Now we've gone to industry and done a survey of what is going to be the investments that are going to be coming over this period, and the amount to go to 50 billion rand, that would be about 5 billion rand per annum. Now at the stage to about 3 billion rand, a kind of about 2 billion rand, and 30% is the amount to a grant of about 15, it's free, and maybe, yeah, it's 6 billion rent at 30%. And the way it would be, the fiscal impact of that is spread, because we do not, if an investor makes an investment this year, the money is spread out over a period of 3 years. The grant is paid over a period of 3 years. So for investments that are going to be made in the last year of the MTF period, we have not budgeted for them in this MTF period. They will be paid over the next MTF period. So I think maybe that's what might be creating confusion. And lastly, in terms of the scheme, what we have agreed with the industry, and we are engaging our sister department, National Treasury, about that, should we find out that, you know, that we do not have sufficient money on budget, we would also look at the issue of the rebates in order for manufacturers to contract rebates.
Thank you very much. I'm sure we still have someone else who's just
Thank you very much, Chair. I just want to pick up on a couple of the questions that were asked earlier. There was a question, I think, right at the beginning about the South Africa, our capacity or building capacity in the area of WTO dispute settlement. I think we've long recognized in the department the need to build up some legal capacity to pursue our not only to submit to the obligations of the WTO, but also to see some of the rights that arise in those agreements, and that requires building up some capacity in that area. In terms of the work program that we've set out in the trade policy and strategy framework document, one of the areas for future work is precisely to build capacity in this area. I think just in terms of a little bit of background in this, South Africa has not been challenged in the WTO in the dispute settlement, and I think had we been challenged any time in the past, we would have had to build up capacity very quickly, but we haven't been challenged, although we have been a third-party member on one case. Case brought a few years ago against U.S. subsidies in the area of maize. So I think just to inform the committee of an intention to develop a work program of building capacity in this area. There was a related question on the question of the SAPU tribunal, and this is one of the gaps in the development of a range of institutions that are envisioned in the SAPU agreement, that we establish a tribunal. Clearly we don't have that in place. But I think, I'm not sure, at this stage, I think it wouldn't be correct to say that if we had a tribunal, that we wouldn't have the situation that we find ourselves in with Swaziland. The legal basis for the Swazi's ban on imports of wheat flour, it's not clear what the legalities of that are. We've been making some assessments on that. Some of these provisions in national legislation in SAPU may have been grandfathered in terms of the new agreement, meaning that if these provisions were in national legislation before the entry into force of the SAPU agreement, they may be still allowed. So we have to make that assessment. But what we have done is at least two consultations with Swaziland on the issue of ban, and our preference would be that we find a out-of-court solution to that issue. Chair, I just want to supplement the Minister's comment on the EPA and strategy on the EPA. Minister has indicated that we have built up a common SAPU position and a common SADC position in the next phase of negotiations. Our next engagement will be in April this year, and in addition to the points that the Minister has raised about a package of negotiating issues of the alignment of tariffs on rules of origin and outstanding issues, we've also have a common agreement that South Africa itself would need to have improved market access into the EU for this agreement to have some value for South Africa. So that's quite an important element. And we've also agreed that none of the members would desist from ratifying the agreement and allowing it to come into force until we address all of these issues. So that's we've built up some kind of common approach on that. I think the last link to this and policy of interest to the committee is the coming into force of the new EU Lisbon Treaty, which allows the European Parliament much greater say in the conduct of trade policy in Europe. And certainly it would be important that the concerns that we have expressed about the economic partnership would be taken up in that context. So that maybe as part of a broader strategy of engaging with the people. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, DG. I just wanted to answer Honourable Khadebe's question about the website. The EU is having project in place to review and revamp the website, and we will have that in place in quarter two in the new financial year. Then, just in terms of some of the facts and the figures, in terms of the data that's available, we have acknowledged that there's a skills transfer process in place, and we are also looking at IT programs to support the data that's required on the website. Thank you.
Thanks. There was a question on the role of technical infrastructure standards and static integration. And just briefly, that is an important part of our work identified under the technical infrastructure work in the Industrial Policy Action Plan. I think there are a couple of elements to this. The one is that the harmonization of standards static, which is work that we can engage with and made quite a lot of progress in terms of kind of broad level agreements within static, opens up opportunities both for the region, it allows for standardization and therefore reaching economies of scale in certain industries within the region, and it also helps facilitate some of our exports into the region, for instance, in areas like automotive and chemicals. So it is definitely a period work that we engage with. It is also complex because at the end of the day, these things have to be kind of ratified by standards need to be implemented in each static state. So even when there's an overall MOU agreement between states, it needs to be put into place within each static state.
That was a question, I think, that was posed by the chair on the fiscal infrastructure program and as to how are we going to make sure that we enhance the impact of the program. The way the fiscal infrastructure works is that it's normally given to, it's a grant given to firms to put in place critical infrastructure in areas where, in the absence of that critical infrastructure and investment, a private sector investment project would not have gone ahead. So, for instance, if a company was establishing in an area where the electricity network was not strong, we might be able to provide a grant to enable the electricity infrastructure in the area to be strengthened. And normally, in order to ensure that we enhance the impact of the program, what we would look at before approving or awarding a grant, we would look at whether we insist that any funding that we provide under the critical infrastructure, the infrastructure should not only be available to the company that is undertaking the investment project, but it should also be available to other companies that might be establishing around that area. And if at all it is a road, we insist that it should be infrastructure in the sense that it is also available to communities. So most of the time, the infrastructure that we are funding would be benefiting a particular project, but it would also be benefiting communities, and it would also be benefiting industries in the area. And then there are other criteria that we put in place, and that would look at how does it help small business, how does it help empowerment, and so forth. Thanks, sir.
Yeah, just to add there, I think the chair said something quite interesting about trickle-down economics, and I think that the answer is the application of trickle-down economics to industrial policy means that downstream industries operate as a trickle.
I think you know where we're coming from. That's for sure. It is like that. Just as you close with Minister and we close this particular session for now, would have been valuable if our Deputy Minister Montuli could just have addressed the issue of the impact of the current procurement in the SMME situation, because that has been raised on several occasions.
Thank you, Chairperson. It's a very complex issue, but I'm willing to put my head on the block. We are still going to discuss it with the minister and, of course, other ministers. I want to challenge everybody to say, you cannot say you are developing small businesses if you don't support them wholly, especially create a market for them. Let me start by the one that seems a little bit, let me not say this. Let me say, as government, we travel a lot. Ministers, deputy ministers, DGGs, DGs, we all sleep in big hotels. Nobody is sleeping in B&Bs. But we claim to be supporting small business. We all want to sleep in big hotels. I can see that everybody is looking down. I sleep in B&Bs. Okay. Now, I am saying, if we create, if we want to create sustainable businesses, let the departments support those businesses. We know that all the departments, I'll cite but two examples, do buy toilet paper, all of them. Provinces, national, municipalities, but where do they buy them? I'm saying at least give us small business people 40, if not 35% of your procurement to sustain those small businesses. You look at our linen in our hospitals. If we create a chain of cooperatives, have the same type of manufacturing cooperatives in Western Cape, in Gauteng, in KwaZulu-Natal, in Mpumalanga, in Limpopo, about four or five of them. One, they have the buying power. They can access raw materials because that is one of their challenges. They can access raw materials. We can even go to SADC and say, Zimbabwe, grow us cotton. Malawi, grow us a lot of cotton. We can spin that. We can come up with our own cotton. We can be able to say, this textile factory is manufacturing for us and for us only. We can be able to say, if time for allocating linen for hospitals, these are the factories that we are going to buy from. I'm not saying let's kill the factories that are there, but I'm saying let's share. Let them give us only 35%. So that we can grow those industries in those areas. I can go on and on and on. I don't want to do that. But when we discuss the small business strategy, I think we'll get deeper into that. But that needs to be communicated to other departments. We need to agree at cabinet we need to agree as the department that they agree with that idea. But I want to drive them. Let them just assist us. Give us a little bit of what they are buying. Give it to small businesses and see if we won't be able to sustain these small businesses, grow them. And in actual fact, if we grow these rural areas and these small businesses in those areas, we'll be able to ease the load of the influx from the rural areas to the cities. In short, that is it.
Members, I think that we are all inspired by that. I think, even these little bakeries which you see other parts of the world also between little parts of the suburbia. Yeah, we can't seem to do that. So I think we certainly concur with you that we need to change our mindset with respect to the purchasing power of organizations and how we can support the SMEs in this regard. But thank you very much to those members who have been able to join us and to those who have been here. Okay. And also to the Minister, Dr. Rob Davey, the Director General, Shadisha Matona. Nearly won't mention all the names, but to the Deputy Minister, Deputy Minister Mansuli, and all the team here present with us today, including some of those who joined us only recently this year. I'm sure perhaps now that we've started to get moving, you've got a few extras on the team. But thank you for sharing with us. There's so many issues and questions that have already come up, which you have alluded to, that I think we're going to have to review the way our strategic program has been developed. We would hope that once again the DG would join us on that session, because we need to focus our work more on what it is, what the priorities are in this area of trade and development, trade and industrial development within the developmental framework of our state. Members, thank you. I know everyone wants to thank us at this point in time. And I'm also thank my staff. Someone mentioned to me the other day that I told them thank them.